Today I'm with Elizabeth Runnicles, and she's going to talk to us about Nancy Mitford. I actually heard Elizabeth giving a talk on Nancy Mitford, and it's absolutely fascinating. What made you start to take an interest in the life of Nancy Mitford, Elizabeth?
Well, I was lucky to be brought up in a fascinating area of London, Chelsea, where my father had a parish, and my mother had met Nancy's sister Jessica, younger sister Jessica, or Decca as she's known in the books, a few times, and was greatly impressed by her. And my mother had also given me The Pursuit of Love when I was sort of early teens, and this in fact is still one of my favourite books. It's a book I'd recommend everybody to read, very good in times of stress, because this account of her family in fictional form, anything that goes wrong, they had it even worse.
I remember, I think I read most of Nancy Mitford's books as a teenager as well, and the you and non-you as well. I used to find the whole thing very amusing.
Well, I think Nancy Mitford is an extraordinary character, in some ways a rather sad character, because she had this outward veneer of great success, great wit, great intelligence. I think her you and non-you business was sheer snobbism. But it was a very snobbish age when she was brought up. She was born in 1904 and died in 1973. One knew one's social class, and she was very firmly in the aristocracy. She was very good at perceiving what lay underneath the witticism and the cleverness. And one has to face the fact that in many ways her life was very sad. She had a failed marriage, she had an unfulfilled relationship with the great love of her life, Le Colonel, a Frenchman, Gaston Palevsky, one of General de Gaulle's aides, who never told her that he loved her, unlike what happens in The Pursuit of Love, when Christian does admit he loves Linda. And all this contrasted very sharply with her literary success and her glittering social life. Underneath, as one of her sisters, Diana, the one who married Moseley, said, underneath, it was so sad, her life, one could hardly bear to contemplate it. But still, it's a fascinating life, and that's why I went into this in some detail, urged on by my mother.
Meanwhile, her childhood was quite interesting as well, wasn't it? It probably had quite an effect on her future life.
Oh, she had an extraordinary childhood, even by the standards. Then she was the eldest of these six children. Her parents were, again, more than a little odd. I'm sure today they'd be categorised as a totally dysfunctional family. Her mother was a very languid lady who actually underneath was a very sharp brain, but she did not believe in germs of any kind. She wouldn't allow the children to be inoculated, she wouldn't allow them to have any kind of medicines, they could only eat certain foods. Her grandfather on her mother's side had in fact been one of the first diplomats to arrive at the court of the Emperor of Japan after the Meiji Restoration in 1868. And had stood at a general election in 1892 with his great friend, the father of David Mitford, Nancy's father, who married in 1894. Now, Nancy Mitford's grandfather was noted for having started the Lady magazine, which still exists today. And David, her father, went to work there because he had no other way of actually paying the bills. Now, when I say actually paying the bills, there was a lot of money in the family. One mustn't sort of think they were on the breadline, far from it. But money was not easy at hand. It was all tied up in land and titles, etc. And this kind of childhood that Nancy had was very strange, even by their standards. She had a succession of governesses, she and her sisters and brother. The brother had the fortune to be sent away to school, Eton, of course. The girls were kept at home and expected to wait to get married. They were not allowed to go to school because they might play games like hockey and develop big muscles, and that wouldn't endear them in the marriage market, which was all that the girls were destined for. And Nancy was clever. Her grandfather, who owned Batsford Park in Gloucestershire, very fortunately had a wonderful library of books, some of them very unsuitable French novels. And fortunately for us, Nancy learnt to read quickly after tormenting the poor old governesses, who changed rapidly, and read her way through some wonderful literature, French and English. and this was largely her education. But her father was a very violent man. He'd had a ghastly time during the Boer War and then during the First World War. But he'd learnt the word sewer, meaning Tamil in Ceylon, or Sri Lanka, meaning pig, which he spelt sewer, S-E-W-E-R, the Tamil is S-U-A, and he applied this phrase sewer to most people he met. He did not like other people, particularly those who came near his family. And he also had learnt the destructive effects of alcohol, and he would drink quite heavily when he was out in Ceylon. And this background of Ceylon, Boer War, First World War, where he did, you know, heroic things. Her father had had a very tough time during the First World War, 1914-18, when he had led trains of ammunition on horseback through the Menin Gate every night, and it had been a very, very tough time. And he would regale the children with ghastly stories of how he'd beaten the Hun, literally knocking them on the head, etc., whenever possible. So she had this background of a mother who really didn't appear to be very interested, a father who had favourites and would chase them round the house, up and down the stairs, particularly when they were just about to go to bed, singularly bad for highly strung children.
So it wasn't a particularly happy childhood, even though it came through in a lot of the books that they had great fun together.
Well, the children had fun together. They made their own amusements. They had the Ons cupboard, as they call it, where they were all the honourable this and that, because the father had succeeded to the title. His old Lord Reedsdale, his older brother, had died in the First World War. And the children wrote their own journal. But the children were happy with each other, but not with the adults, definitely not. And this view of the adult world undoubtedly coloured her relationships later in life. And she was also quite determined that she should be the centre of attention. She disliked her next sister, Pam, who wasn't very bright. She got on better with Diana, who came along next. And it was a sad relationship with these sisters. Diana was the one she got on best, the one who went off with Oswald Mosley as his second wife eventually, having married one of the Guinnesses first. And it was an early childhood that was fraught with apparent lack of money, but there was always a crisis of money when they would change houses and move down to a smaller house. But it was all relative, because by most majority of people's standards, they had plenty of money in the background if it was really necessary. But what Nancy really longed to do was to go to school. And this, as I said earlier, that the father adamantly refused, because that would not fit her for the marriage market.
So Nancy must have been longing to leave the house then and to get away from it all, as she hadn't been able to go away to school even, or even go to school.
Well, she'd had a very short spell at a boarding school, but that had been singularly unfortunate. I think one of the people who owned it had made a pass at her, but we better pass over that quickly. She did, in fact, manage to get to Paris with a few other girls when she was 17 in April 1922, and she thought she was in heaven. She had never seen such wonderful shops, such beautiful clothes, and as she said, it's all so heavenly, it's all too lovely, oh, such fun. But of course, it was ghastly coming back, because her father would not let her wear any makeup. Only loose women, prostitutes, would wear makeup. She wanted to have her hair cut short and shingled, and that again was not allowed. The girls didn't have their hair cut short or anything done to it until after they had married. And she was fighting her parents all the time. She did actually manage also to get to Florence and Venice. And when she came back, she wrote to one of her friends, "I really am a femme du monde now, especially when I wear a fur," which really dates her. But the prospect of coming back to cold, dreary England was absolutely terrible. But Paris was to be the great love of her life. She absolutely adored it. And when she was 18, of course, as in the book The Pursuit of Love, the novel, there's this wonderful description of trying to organise a dance, her coming out dance, and nobody knew any young men. The only young men were around were friends of her brother, who was only 13, and the old relations in the House of Lords who were bought out. And as she said, it wasn't at all like floating away into a delicious cloud pressed by a manly arm to a manly bosom, but stumble, stumble, kick, kick. Anyway, out she came, and the great thing about that was that at least the family took a house in London for the season, the summer season, and she was allowed to go to parties, but always, of course, with a chaperone. She had also been presented at court, which was a very chilly affair. They were all dressed up in white satin, ostrich feathers and gloves, etc., to curtsy to the King and Queen, George V and Queen Mary. No more sophisticated arrangement was offered at Buckingham Palace in those days than a chamber pot behind a screen. Anyway, at least she was out in society. And this is when she had her first London season in 1923.
So she came out as a debutante. She'd been to Paris, and so she was now ready for London life and the world.
Yes, and this is the point at which she started to make acquaintances and friends, which her father totally disapproved. Well, one has to remember that the world of London after the First World War ended in 1918 was a world which had changed dramatically. The young who had survived the war were determined to live life to the full, to have what were regarded as scandalous parties, fancy dress parties. They used to love to run over the counters at Selfridges, all dressed up like Red Indians, etc. And to us it seems rather infantile, but to them it was very high spirits, because they never knew when the next war might come and again lose such vast numbers of young men. And it was among these country house parties that she went to that she was to meet a whole group who were known as the aesthetes. Some of them were to be at college later with her brother, but and some were at Oxford, not far from where she was living in the Cotswolds. But she met Mark Ogilvy Grant, who was very amusing and adored playing the fool with her, Brian Howard, who was Oliver Messel, and these were very attractive young men, mostly homosexual. And it's extraordinary that Nancy was attracted to these sort of fluttering butterflies, because in a way she had realised that she could achieve preeminence in their society by her clever wit. She realised that if she was going to be hurt by a remark, she could turn it into a witticism, and then the hurt would be deflected away from her. And she was always absolutely adamant that she was going to be the centre of attraction. We would say a thoroughly selfish individual, but this was how she viewed her role in life, given all these sisters back at home who were sort of hounding her footsteps and trying to, you know, achieve success as well, and given the parents' attitude towards her. But the trouble was, what was she to do? She didn't have any career, and it was felt that something had to be done, and eventually she was able to get a job in a bookshop in London at the beginning of the war, which was to again lead to a big meeting in her life.
So now Nancy was grown up and having a wonderful time, and presumably looking for the husband that her parents had hoped that she would marry.
Well, yes, the problem was that the group of young men that she was mixing amongst were certainly not going to be good marriage material, according to her parents. They were mostly homosexuals, and the one she absolutely adored, Hamish Sinclair Erskine, was a very narcissistic, beautiful young man, but in no way was he going to be a good husband. He did, in fact, introduce her to a very artistic intelligentsia group, Lytton Strachey, Carrington, Augustus John, the Sitwells, and she met Evelyn Waugh at this time and started a very long correspondence, which is absolutely fascinating. It's recently been published by one of Diana Mitford's granddaughters. But this so-called engagement with Hamish Sinclair Erskine was never going to come to anything. Meanwhile, of course, the family was going through most dreadful traumas because Diana, her next sister, third sister of the Mitford girls, had walked out on her first husband, Brian Guinness, and set up with Oswald Mosley, who was later to become the fascist leader. And this was considered singularly shocking, because his wife, Cynthia, daughter of one of Lord Curzon's daughters, refused to give him a divorce. She was a Roman Catholic. And the whole setup was considered quite dreadful. And the only way in which this so-called engagement with Hamish Sinclair Erskine was ended was that he announced his engagement to somebody else. Well, within a month, although she'd been heartbroken, she was engaged to somebody else, and this was to be Peter Rodd.
So she got engaged and presumably got married, and Diana was on her second marriage to Oswald Mosley. Presumably they were they ostracised at this point because of it or not?
Well, Nancy always kept on good terms with all her sisters as far as possible, although later during the war unity proved a problem, but I'll come to that. She always was on good terms with Diana because Diana would always let her use her house in London, and that was an escape route from the property wherever she lived, was living in the Cotswolds with the parents. Now, Peter Rodd was an extraordinary character. His father was ambassador in Rome, and there was a lovely poem about him. Mr. Peter Rodd is extraordinarily like God. He has the same indefinable air of savoir-faire. In other words, he thought he knew the lot. A very beautiful man. He adored women and drink and gambling. He was not good husband material, but at least he wasn't a homosexual. Anyway, a splendid wedding was held in St. Margaret's Westminster, the place for weddings, and they set up a married life together. But unfortunately, things did not go well. Money was the big problem. Her mother-in-law, who was known as Tiger Lil, quite a character from the embassy in Rome, used to send her cheques at times to help out. Nancy began writing articles for magazines. They had a delightful little house on the Thames at Strand-on-the-Green near Kew Bridge. She enjoyed being married, but in a way she was playing at it. She wasn't really living life properly. When she talked about poor life, poor people, one has to remember an income of £500 a year was a considerable amount of money in those days. And she had allowances from her parents and from his parents. But what was most difficult was that Peter was unfaithful to her, and this she found very, very hard to take because he made no bones about it. And she realised soon, by 1936, that life was not going to be easy. She did, in fact, stay with him for a few more years, and during the war they were divorced.
So she had started to write at this point, but hadn't really become recognised for it.
Yes, she'd done some journalism, and she'd written a couple of novels which were very much in the 1930s sort of style, not considered good books at all now, for example, Wicks on the Green. Well, that's quite interesting because her sister Unity is in it. And she had mentioned the fascists who were emerging in Europe. This was about 1934. But by 1936, a terrible year for the Mitfords, absolutely dreadful year, because by this time, Diana was married to Mosley. Pam, the second sister, had married Derek Jackson, who was pretty pro-fascist. But then remember the Clifton set, that most of the aristocracy regarded Hitler as a good thing, a good counterbalance to communism in Russia at the time. The family house, Swinbrook House, had been sold, and father only kept the old mill cottage near High Wycombe, which was a sort of bolt hole for them all. He increasingly spent a lot of time up in Scotland. And the next sister, Unity, was going on frequent visits to Germany, since she regarded Hitler as an absolute god and in fact attended the Olympic Games. And her mother went over to see her there and came back and reported what wonderfully good manners Hitler had. So it was a family that was increasingly being rent, because Jessica, further down the scale, had eloped with her cousin Romilly to Spain, and he was later to take part in the Spanish Civil War. He then, just to follow him up, he then later joined the Air Force, English Air Force, and died during the Second World War, which began 1939. And she was later to marry in America a pro-union lawyer. But that's another story of Jessica. But the whole family was finding life very tricky indeed. Deborah, the youngest, who is the Dowager Duchess of Devonshire now, she was to marry Andrew, who was the second son of the Duke of Devonshire. His older son married one of the Kennedy girls and died during the war. That she married in 1944, I think it was, if I remember rightly. Anyway, the whole family were going to be rent apart by all these marriages, and with the emerging of fascism in Europe, pro and con. Nancy always regarded herself as a socialist, which may come as a little surprise, but it was relative to her family being mostly, not all, but apart from Jessica, on the side of Hitler. Unity, of course, had been named Unity Valkyrie, rather prophetically, because Unity was the name of an actress when she was born in 1915, and Valkyrie was the name of her grandfather's favourite opera. Rather prophetic.
So, of course, now the war was coming along, and they were very fascist. I suppose the whole family were very fascist, which must have had an effect on their lives.
Yes, it did. They were split, literally, with Nancy and Jessica on one side and the others on the other side. Father retreated to Scotland and his estates up there and virtually, you know, stayed there. But with the beginning of the war, the Moseleys were imprisoned in Holloway, separately at first, and then they were allowed to be together in 1941. Nancy did keep in touch with them, although she regarded them as rather dangerous, but I think she thought it might be wise to keep in touch with them just in case the Germans invaded, and then she could appeal. She did actually take great care, helped with the care of their two of Diana's two children by Brian Guinness. Now, Unity, of course, had been in Germany when war was declared, and had shot herself in the mouth and was survived this, was sent to Bern by Hitler and collected there by her mother, and she was a pitiful wreck and eventually was to die of meningitis. They went to live at the Old Mill Cottage near High Wycombe. It was a depressing time for Nancy and Peter. Both were having affairs, Peter openly, Nancy less openly. They hadn't had any children, she'd had frequent miscarriages. And then she joined the Allies Club in Park Lane, which is where the Free French used as a social base for the officers. And she had some wonderful friendships, in inverted commas, there with some of the French officers. But one person in particular she met at this time was Jim Lees-Milne, who was at West Wycombe Park, very much involved with the National Trust. And it was through him that she got a little job in a little bookshop just off Piccadilly, and this is where she was able to save a little money for herself. The trouble was that she always spent all her time talking to her friends then. Somebody once said, a little less of the darling, please, and a little more attention would help. But she had many friends there, particularly Jerry Wellesley, now the Duke of Wellington, Gerald Berners, who became Lord M in The Pursuit of Love, Osbert Sitwell, Raymond Mortimer, Evelyn Waugh. And then in 1942, most prophetic and most important for her, as far as her emotional life was concerned, she met the colonel, the colonel, Frenchman, Gaston Palevsky, Polish descent, who to the English epitomised a sophisticated Frenchman. He was not very good-looking in a film star way, short, stocky, but very amusing, very clever with words, a great lover of the arts, and an incorrigible womanizer, also a very shrewd politician. And he adored talking to Nancy at the Allies Club, and she entertained him with stories of her family, and they became lovers. But then, sadly for her, in 1944, was preparations being made for the invasion of Europe, and the Normandy landings, and he went off to help de Gaulle, who was one of his right-hand men, and she was left on her own, and her big problem was how to get to Paris, and this is where the bookshop came in handy. She was able to save up some money from working there. She'd had a very sad time when her brother Tom was killed in early 1945 in Burma, where he'd been fighting. He'd been one of her earliest confidants, but she was terribly anxious to join Le Colonel in Paris. He had made very great offers of hospitality, etc., but these turned rather cold when she said she was actually coming. Her father gave her £3,000 to buy a partnership in the bookshop, but she used this, in fact, to go to Paris. And this was absolutely wonderful. She arrived in Paris in the autumn of 1945.
So we find Nancy now in Paris again. In fact, of course, she hadn't really started making her mark with her books at this point, had she?
No, she was to really get going as a writer in order to stay in Paris and subsidise her life there to be with the colonel. And The Pursuit of Love was published in 1945, and it was an instant success. It had everything that the English wanted after the long years of the war. which had finished in 1945. It had an upper crust family, it had love, it had laughter. It's a wonderful book. If you haven't read it, I would recommend it. And the same characters are used in the following sequence to this, Love in a Cold Climate, 1948. The same family of Radlets come into it, their daughter Polly. There's a wonderful, humorous characters, Cedric and Lady Montdor. And again, I would recommend you to read that. The two really go together. They are great fun. But she also began to write more serious books. She became really a very serious historian in many respects. Interesting the topic she chose, Madame de Pompadour, the great mistress and supporter of the arts, Louis XV. Louis XIV, the Sun King, the Colonel, was her son. Frederick the Great, who was a very dominant man. Very interesting that she chose to write about these people. But despite her sort of well-off life now, glittering social success, underneath, I'm afraid her life with the Colonel was sad. He always said he could never marry her because she was divorced by now, and then he went and married a divorced duchess who was very wealthy. He would never allow her to tutoyer him. And then she became very ill with Hodgkin's disease and died really in dreadful pain and suffering. But the sisters all rallied round. And the last person who came to see her just before she died in June 1973 was the Colonel. And she died happy in that sense.
That's a lovely story. Thank you very much indeed, Elizabeth. And we never mentioned you and none you.
Well, none you and none you I regard as a very snobbish episode, typical of a certain stage. But I don't think, well, maybe you'll remember it, but I think her books are far more valuable.
Elizabeth has just shown me a lovely collection of photographs of the family. There's one here of Deborah, the Duchess of Devonshire, feeding her chickens, which is quite amazing. She seems to be dressed in a ball gown with a bucket and feed.
Yes, they had this extraordinary mixture that in many ways they were very down to earth. In other ways, they lived in another world for most of us. Deborah was a very sound businesswoman. She restored Chatsworth when they had the most ghastly 7 million at least of death duties to pay. Her father-in-law died very quickly after the last Duke. And they are an extraordinary family who survived often on their wits. And this, I think, is what is so interesting about them. Whether they would have been people we'd have actually liked to have known, I'm not sure. But certainly, Nancy lives on through the wits of her book.
Thank you very much indeed, Elizabeth. I hope people will read some of those of Nancy Mitford's books if they haven't already done so.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed talking about her.